This is March 30th in the year 2001, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing James Atwater at the Chapel Hill Public Library. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm well, thank
good,
you.
Good.
I appreciate your spending time on this hectic two-day trip here to allow me to interview, and I know you've been interviewed to death almost, probably, and I just we'll get started right away with open-ended question, and that is, what was it like growing up in Chapel Hill, and when did you grow up in Chapel Hill?
My growing up period probably extends from the mid-1930s until, we would say, the 1940s, late 1940s, because I graduated from high school, from Lincoln High School in 1949. During the earlier years, memories, of course, fade from the very earliest years, but one of the memories that I do have specifically about what I think was representative of the attitude of my parents was that I was taken to Woolen Gymnasium when President Franklin D. Roosevelt made what turned out to be his only visit to Chapel Hill as President of the United States. And my mother took my brother and me down to Woolen Gym to see him. I have been to the archives at the university to check the dates, and I don't have the exact date in mind, but I do have it in a short paper that I've written about it. In any case, it was the 1930s. He was, I think, probably campaigning for a second term as president. And my mother felt that it was important for her to take my brother and me to see a president of the United States. We saw his motorcade come up the Pittsburgh Highway. He had stopped over in Southern Pines on the way here, and we did not get into the gymnasium. We didn't get into Woolen because, of course, the crowd was already there, and I'm not sure that we would have been allowed in as spectators in any case. Nevertheless, we could hear his address over the public address system, which they had set up for those who were outside. We had to do that in the rain because it was a rainy day. I remember that, rainy, just a bit chilly. But I think that that was something that my mother felt that she wanted to do for us, perhaps for our memory, or at least she could tell us that we had been there. But I do remember that we did it. And I think that was representative of the attitude that she took toward exposing her children to, we can say, the political process, or we can say to the world around them, to the important things that were going on in the world around them. And she carried that attitude throughout our early school years, because one of the things that she did was to stop working. She had worked for a while. She had worked at North Carolina Mutual. She had been a secretary there. She had also sold insurance for North Carolina Mutual and in the Chapel Hill area. But she decided to remain at home during the entire period we were growing up in school, and I think she probably remained at home as a homemaker until my youngest sister was perhaps at the age when my mother felt that she could more or less be on her own. So the growing up for me is primarily the experience of having my mother at home whenever one can say, perhaps whenever we needed her, but she did things such as prepare breakfast for us in the morning before we went to school. We always went to school with a breakfast. We were close enough to the school. We lived on Church Street, and we were so close to the school that we could come back home for lunch even, and we did that for a number of years. Occasionally, of course, we would take a lunch to school, or we could get a lunch somewhere nearby because there were small pre-7-Eleven stores in the neighborhood between our house and the school. But I think that what characterized it for me was the atmosphere at home of a mother who was there, a father who was there fairly often, but nevertheless the fact that the family that I grew up in an atmosphere that was characterized primarily by the home experience. One of the other aspects of growing up in Chapel Hill and my personal situation was that obviously we knew most of the other kids who were in school because it was a fairly small school. But a number of our schoolmates lived in our neighborhood. We were in what we called, of course, Potter's Field at the time, and we had relationships with those children that we could maintain very easily because we were all in walking distance of one another. It was very easy to maintain the physical contact, if you will. And we also built in our backyard, we put up a couple of basketball courts, and this came primarily during the high school years, but that proved to be an attraction for many of the kids in our neighborhood and also from the other neighborhoods as we grew up, because they came to our house to play basketball, and sometimes we'd have, especially on Saturdays or on Sundays, a group of 20, 30, 40 kids who were playing basketball in our house. So things rotated to a certain degree around our house and around the homes of other, especially neighbors who lived nearby and other friends that we made as we went along. So it was an experience which was one that one might say transcended the physical location of our home, but even in that transfer from one physical location to another, it was still a matter of being in someone's home, and being in someone's home usually under the supervision of an adult. The other aspect of it, as I grew older near high school, we spent a good bit of time in other areas around Chapel Hill. We had swimming holes during the summer. We'd go there as a group, of course, practically everyone knowing everyone else. We spent time at UNC on, for example, attending football games primarily during the football season. But there were other things that were going on the campus to which we had access. I remember, again, this is from the high school years. We went to the Forest Theater on one occasion when a company had come in from out of town to film a movie. And they were using UNC, I don't remember the name of the movie, but they were using UNC, using the Forest Theater for one of the segments of the movie. And I read about it in the newspapers, I mentioned it to my teacher, and my teacher took us on a field trip so that we could sit in the Forest Theater and watch that. So that, again, this is, as I say, the high school years, but it's representative of the fact that the university provided a facility for us, we can say on an informal basis, because for that particular case, no one invited us to come to see that, but when we went, no one prohibited us from coming and sitting there and watching that. And from the work standpoint, of course, my father was working at the university, as you know, during most of that period, and I would go to the university with him from time to time, either to help him. My brother and I often would go to help him with some of the things, that some of his duties. But that meant we were on the campus, in any case, and we had the opportunity to observe some of the things that went on the college campus.
So are you saying that the university had a profound influence on your community?
Absolutely. And this is one of the aspects, I think, of the size of Chapel Hill at that time, and of course the size of the university. The university obviously was not as large, it didn't have as large a population then as it does now. But proportionately, the university dominated the town. There was no question about that. Dominated not so much necessarily from assuming a role of dominance, but simply the fact that they were the largest employer. I think statistically, I've never seen this documented, but I think they were probably the largest employer as far as direct employees are concerned, but also from the indirect standpoint, that is, people who were faculty, administrators, staff at the university, often had as employees in their homes or as auxiliary personnel, one might say, ancillary personnel, people from the community of Chapel Hill. So that directly or indirectly, the economic aspect of it was a reflection of the size and the economic power, wherewithal, of the university in this town. And I've mentioned this earlier too, the university was operated utilities, the telephone system, the water, electricity, it was a university laundry, et cetera, et cetera. So that from that standpoint, the university relationship with Chapel Hill was one that Chapel Hill was, perhaps some might say, a support mechanism for the University of North Carolina. But by the same token, the personal relationships that were established between the university and some of the people in Chapel Hill also provided a kind of a support mechanism from the standpoint of the advice that people might receive as individuals from the university and other types of support that they might receive from it.
Can you tell me more about the community? It sounds as though you grew up in a stable home with a mother who focused her attention on raising children, didn't work outside the home. Was this typical of the community?
I would not go so far as to say it was typical of the community. I think that a number of families were in similar circumstances. But I think that the economic realities of the time simply would not have permitted all of the families, or most of the families, most of the African-American families, be in that type of situation. I knew several of my friends, some of my close friends, were in similar situations. But I know also that there were families which did not have, I don't want to call it that luxury, but I know that there were families which were not in quite that same, did not have exactly the same advantages that we had by having our mother there. And of course, the reason, excuse me, that we had that advantage was because my father made, an extraordinary effort to provide economic for his family. And I've mentioned this before, but the things that he did, the job, of course, his primary employment was with the university. But even being at the university were several, we can say, part-time responsibilities he had, so that sometimes before he went to work at the, went to his, took his, performed his duties at the university, before he showed up for work at the university, he might have already have done something for someone on a private, say, a private family, while he, after work, could have been the same thing on the weekends. Of course, he had some light duties at the university on the weekends, but after he had finished those, he might be doing something else. So that simply was the attitude that he took as far as providing for us. Now, from the other standpoint, some families, I know, were obtaining compensation for work that the mother was doing at home. For example, taking in laundry. The mother may have been doing laundry at home. She could be at home. She'd do the laundry. She'd prepare it and so on. Maybe deliver it or someone would pick it up. But she was bringing in income for the family, but she was also at home for the children. I think once we get into this area, the issue of single-parent households probably comes up. Personally, I'm not familiar with that many. I just don't remember that many. I think there probably were some. And one of the circumstances at the time, this goes to the, of course, the policy of the state administration, we can say the welfare situation, and I'm not sure when I was growing up whether this was the case, but I know in later years, a policy decisions created a situation in which fathers sometimes had to abandon their families in order to permit the family to qualify for welfare assistance. So sometimes there were single parent households that were a reflection of that policy. But there were also cases where the father, and perhaps more often than not, a father rather than a mother, who was not available for whatever reason, simply did not take his responsibilities or left or separated from the family and did not provide the support that the family needed. And as I say, I'm not personally familiar with very much, I just don't recollect many situations like that, but I'm sure they did exist. And we had students who were, we can say, truants, students who got into difficulties that eventually led them to reform school. Called the juvenile facilities reform schools. As a matter of fact, just as an aside, Orange County Training School, the name, as you probably already know, was one that was also used, training was also used for those juvenile facilities for reform schools in the state of North Carolina. And from time to time, we would be automatically tainted with that when we go to other cities on sports. People would think automatically that, well, this is a reform school. Of course, we weren't. And again, as an aside, my mother was one of the prime movers behind the campaign to change the name of the school. She said that she was president of PT, I think, at the time, and I was the first from our family to graduate. And she said that no son of mine is going to graduate from a training school, and we're just going to have to change the name of the school. And that's we went through the looking at various and came up finally with Lincoln. But in any case, I do know personally of boys, for example, and I think probably one girl at least, who eventually wound up in reform school because of difficulties that they had with the law. And they didn't necessarily, as I can recall, one of them came from a two-parent family. I think that probably the mother was working. Another came from a family, and I think that it was a situation in which the father was somewhere in the city, and the father had acknowledged him. I'm not sure about his mother, but it was very difficult for anyone to control him. He had his own way of thinking, doing things, and eventually he didn't wind up in reform school. I know of another one who went to reform school. Again, he went from a two-parent family. The father and mother were together, and I'm not sure whether the mother was working or not, but things like that did happen. I think that the redeeming factor in this perhaps is that parents in general, the community in general, either tried to, we can say, shield or shelter the children from the realities of that kind of situation when they were children and perhaps not yet mature enough to put that kind of thing in perspective. And when the children were old enough, when the parents, the community felt that they were old enough, I don't think there was any effort to shield anyone from that. Those things did happen. Alcoholism, there was some alcoholism. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I just don't think it was the defining characteristic of the community. And often when it, even those who were considered alcoholics, some of them I know, some of them that I know personally, attempted to maintain some kind of, let us say, stability in working at least from time to time, rather than, say, simply consuming alcohol, becoming completely inebriated and of no value whatsoever to the community. So that things like that happened, I'm sure, and if we go into the issue of children out of wedlock, I'm sure, yes, there were children out of wedlock. Usually, though, for most of the situations that I can recall personally, families made an effort, first of all, to put those children into a situation which was family-oriented. For example, an aunt, an uncle, a grandparent might ostensibly adopt that child or might even claim that child as their own. Perhaps most people in the community knew exactly what the situation was, but they tried to put, we can say, if not necessarily legitimize the situation entirely, not to let that kind of thing serve as a, we can say, a stigma to the extent that the child was abandoned to its own devices, or that the child wound up, say, in an orphan home or whatever. And of course, I think once we get into issues like that, perhaps it's inevitable that somebody brings up the issue of abortions. And that, I say I don't have personal knowledge of. I don't think that that was something that was widely practiced in any case. I think it was, people probably tried to avoid that to the extent possible.
We could spend more time on the community, but our time is limited, so
sure.
Let's move on to the school. I would like to know the activities that you were involved in at the school, and then get on to the teachers and the principal. But I know that you were involved in a lot of activities, so if you could tell me some, or all of them. I'd love to hear all of them.
I would preface that by saying that our school was, again, so small that practically everyone had to play multiple roles, because we simply did not have enough people to go around to have the kinds of programs that we wanted to have. Personally, I was on the basketball team, for one thing. I was on the football team. Football, I didn't play a great deal, but I was on the team for a couple of years or so. I was in the drama club. We did one or two plays, usually one, say, three-act play a year, and occasional one-act plays. One play we did take to the state festival one year, in which I had a role. I was also active with the newspaper for a time, the Campus Echo, and the band. I may have already mentioned I was in the band, the choir, and I served in student government president, 1 year while I was there. I think those probably were all of the activities. But as I said, the size of the school did that, and of course my major interest was in perhaps basketball. I enjoyed that perhaps more than anything else. And as I said earlier, during even before high school and during high school, we had a little court in our backyard, so we had a chance to play a bit more basketball. Of course, we could watch, we saw Carolina games from time to time. The student government was one of the most interesting aspects from the standpoint of what I feel was an interest in politics and working closely with the school administration. And moving on to the teachers and the principal, I think that the, again, defining characteristic of one will was the personal interest that the teachers did take in us as students. And I think that the teachers made a genuine effort to know as much as they could about us as individuals and to try to help us to strengthen, we might say, the positive and to eliminate or at least reduce the negatives. And I know that the name of Ms. Turner has come up before in some of the conversations, and I feel that Ms. Turner, of course, especially from my own personal standpoint, encouraged me to a great degree because of my interest in reading, because of my interest in the French language. She was also the French teacher. And in addition to that, of course, she was the advisor to the drama club. So she was in de facto the director of the plays. And for at least in those three areas, she encouraged me to try to develop what talent she felt that I had in those languages, in reading, understanding literature, and writing, and also in learning as much as I could about not just the French language, but French culture while I was still in high school. And I think that was, again, a characteristic of most of the teachers. One of the teachers who, of course, is still living in Chapel Hill, Mr. R.D. Smith, also took that kind of interest in us as individuals. And, of course, I took courses under him in the shop, some of the agriculture courses, but he was also the advisor. And maybe I have to add one more activity, and that activity was the New Farmers of America. The New Farmers of America was the African-American equivalent, I think probably to 4-H clubs, but there may have been another organization in the white schools. But the New Farmers of America was a national organization of high school students who were interested in agriculture. And in addition to the activities that we did at our own school, as I said, it was a national organization, so that we, on at least one occasion, this did not, eventually it just did not happen for one specific reason. But I was supposed to attend, or at least I was on the verge of possibly attending a national New Farmers of America convention, which would have been held in Tuskegee, at Tuskegee Institute. And if I had attended, it would have been as a member of the band, which was being organized in North Carolina, to go as a North Carolina representative band to the national convention in Tuskegee. But that was the year when we had a polio outbreak. And the polio outbreak during the summer, early summer, caused the organization to cancel that national convention. But the other benefit of the New Farmers of America, again, from my personal standpoint and from the standpoint of my other friends, classmates who were in it, was that we had an opportunity to practice parliamentary procedure, because the New Farmers of America had a very, very well organized procedure for opening meetings, for closing meetings, and for following Robert's Rules of Order, and so on. And Mr. Smith sat in as the advisor for that group. And of course, some of the students who were in that group were still living on farms, Many of us were not living on farms. I happened to be living in Chapel Hill, within the city limits of Chapel Hill. In the past, we had a few domestic animals and so on when regulations were permitted, before regulations were invented in Chapel Hill. But in any case, that also gave us the opportunity to learn a bit more about agriculture. We learned about things in class, but in the New Farmers of America, we learned we could go beyond what we were doing in class. This was an extracurricular activity. Gave us a parliamentary procedure, but also introduced us to a good deal about agriculture. So I'm saying that Mr. Smith, in his capacity as the agriculture shop and agriculture instructor, obviously took his responsibilities in the classroom very seriously, but he took his responsibilities with the New Farmers very seriously. And he was also a member of our church. He was at church. We'd see him at church on Sunday. He lived in the neighborhood. Mr. Smith, as you may already know, lived on the street with the Caldwells. My street, Church Street, intersected with that. We were about a block away. We'd see him. And another thing that he made his choice based on, obviously, his personal values, but he went into the military after he had been here for just a year or two, I think. And in any case, he came back to Chapel Hill afterwards.
But Jim, can you tell me the both the positive and the negative aspects of the school? I guess I'm somewhat fearful that the school is being portrayed as a Shangri-La, and it certainly wasn't that, but it was a positive force in the African-American community. So if you could hit on that issue of the positive and the negative aspects of the school, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I think perhaps from what I've said earlier, that I feel the positive definitely outweighed the negatives. From the standpoint of the interests of the instructors, the interests of the teachers and the students, the efforts by the teachers to, one might say, integrate themselves into the community, to remain as aware as possible of the circumstances under which students were coming to school. What was the home situation, and how was the home situation affecting their performance in school? I think from the negative standpoint, perhaps one might say, I'm sure some would say, that the discipline perhaps was a bit harsh because of the contrast for some people between previous principals and, say, Mr. McDougall, if we're going to refer to an individual. Mr. McDougall came following, and I would say more than one principal, perhaps, whom I did not know as well as I knew Mr. McDougall. And that, I have to say that, in my effort to be objective about it. But I think that some of the students who did know, knew better the earlier principals, might have felt Mr. McDougall was a bit more of a disciplinarian than the others had been. And I think that to a certain extent that was perhaps one of the few ways that he could establish himself, that is, by being different in that way from what he felt the situation represented to him when he arrived, what he saw when he came there. And in doing that, that to some students, again, I think as a reflection of, one might say, the situation in their homes, where they perhaps were not being disciplined the way they should have been. So they saw the contrast between what was happening at school and what happened at home. And I think there may have been also, and this, I may be going way out on a limb in saying this, but I think there may have also been an attitude on the part of some parents that was more adversarial toward the school and toward schooling than for many of the other parents. And that could be explained on the basis of the fact that we were still in a situation where many of the students, especially in high school, may have been the first ones in their families to, if not graduate, maybe even to attend high school. Because that was not that much of a pattern. I mean, that had never been that much of a pattern in the African-American community. That is, a small group certainly went to school, remained in school, but because of the economic situation, many children were obliged to leave school or to spend much less time in school because the family lived on a farm during harvest time, or that the family requirements were such that they needed someone else to bring in an income, and the students had to drop out. And sometimes dropping out was not necessarily because the student was bored with school or just didn't want to go to school anymore because of some kind of pressure from the family. So we were getting, we had at that time, I think, and I hesitate to say this because I don't have any documentation for it, and I must admit I was not making a study of it at the time. But I think there were probably some parents who were saying to themselves, I didn't finish high school, but I'm working, I have a job, I have an income. Why should I let this child do it? I think if that was happening, that was a minority, but I think that might explain some of the reaction to the kind of discipline that Mr. McDougall, I have to say, in the eyes of some people, may have seen. On the other hand, I just did not have the impression that the discipline was that harsh from my personal standpoint. I have to say that. And it wasn't because my mother and father had already told me that they didn't want any problems coming home from school. I think I had the motivation. I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn as much as I could because I felt that I wanted to go on to college. I certainly felt that the entire time I was in high school. And I was being encouraged to do that by family, friends, teachers, and one other teacher I'd mentioned in that context was the band director and music instructor, Mr. Pickard, who near the end of my senior year, he had a group of us, all of the seniors who were in the choir and the band, for a session in his office, and he said to us, you need to look around you and take this moment in, because this is the last time you'll ever be together like this. We're going to graduate in a few days. And then he sort of went around the room to each one of us saying, you should go on to college. What you've done in the band, or what you've done in the choir, what you've done in music, or what you've done whatsoever. And again, the personal reference, he said to me, you play basketball, or maybe you want to go
try getting a basketball scholarship, athletic scholarship, or you've been in a band, you could try that, or you've been student government, et cetera, saying that he felt that all of those avenues, if you will, were open to me as an individual because of what he had seen in me in high school, and not just based on what I had done with the band. I was in the band, but I don't think I'd taken many music courses, but in any case, that he did that for practically everyone in the room, encouraging us based on what he had seen us achieve in high school, whether it was with him or not, just what he had seen, what he knew about us from the rest of our high school.
Was he typical? I mean, that's a tremendous compliment to that man, what you're saying.
Well, I think I tried to name three people, and choosing those three people, and I wouldn't say it was typical of all of the instructors, every one of the instructors. Those three were, certainly they were outstanding as far as I was concerned personally. But I think that the attitude in general was like that. I think that many of the teachers, again, looked at us really as individuals, saw us as individuals, as opposed to the numbers that the school was so small in the first place that they could, without a great effort, know us as individuals. But I think there's been able to looked at us that way. So I think we have to contrast that, I'm trying to put into context the discipline issue. If the discipline was, and if we use the word harsh, I think that what Mr. MacDougall was trying to do was, first of all, correct the situation that he felt he might have inherited. And I think from the other standpoint, to make sure that we retained as much of the positive in us as we could, as opposed to the negative. And I don't know whether that explains it entirely or not, but I think that the negatives that would have to exist, some might say, in any situation, some of them were there. I don't think there's any denying that there were some negatives there. And trying to think of specific examples other than perhaps the discipline issue, we can go to, if you like, the lack of resources. You compare what we had with the white school, obviously we didn't have the same thing. Why didn't we have it? Well, of course, one reason was that some people just didn't want to give it to us. But some might say, well, one of the reasons was that our administrators, Mr. MacDougall and the others, just didn't work hard enough to get it. Well, I can say that, but no. I mean, those are all suppositions that people can bring into a situation like that. But without strict documentation, I'm hesitant to say that any of that existed. And trying to go directly to the issue of Shangri-La, we have to realize that in any situation like this, this is revisionist history, isn't it? We're trying to reconstruct what went on, I know in my mind, years and years ago, and my memories of it, well, we can say my positive memories of it, simply overwhelm the negatives, and that is the way I see it, and certainly I welcome anyone else who has other views.
One last question.
Sure.
What was the value of teachers visiting your homes? Was there value? Excuse me.
Yeah. Well, no. I think there was value. I think there was value from the standpoint of establishing a channel of communication with the parents. I think that was one thing. Because I know that I cannot say that every teacher visited every student's home. I can't say that. But I think that, first of all, it let the parents know that the teacher had enough interest in the child to come to their home. And I think it was also an invitation to the parents to come to the school, if they wanted to come to the school. Parent teachers, or for whatever reason. I think that another value of it was that the teacher could see the facilities that were available, the facilities or the, we could say, the support, the books, the magazines, the newspapers, and so on, that were available in the home. And I think that the teacher could also see, probably to a certain extent, the dynamics of the relationship between the parent and the child. And now, I don't know of very many, and I just can't remember very many visits of teachers to our home. I know that my mother went to the school, my father went to the school. There were times when I went with them and go to PTA meetings or sometimes a special program. This is after school at night. I went with my mother a couple of times that way, and this was when I was fairly young. So I think those are some of the primary values, and I don't think we had a lunchroom at school. From the earliest I remember was a lunchroom which was operated in, I know you've heard about Miss Pope, it was operated in Miss Pope's classroom, and for a small number of tables, I think. And they would have something rather, maybe it was a soup and a sandwich or something like that for lunch. And I don't remember how much it cost or anything like that. But you, I'm sure, are aware of the fact that now many schools, certain schools in the inner cities, Washington is sort of a prime example of it, have a breakfast for the kids. Because many of those kids are coming to school without breakfast. It may be coming without dinner.